Paul Dreyer. I'm here on behalf of the estate of Robin Warmington. Just to give a little background on the facts of the case, this is a divorce case that rose out of a marriage between Robin and Jamie Warmington. They were married in January of 2007, separated in December in 2016. Miss Warmington filed for divorce in 2016, partly in part based on domestic violence that she was experiencing in the marriage, which resulted in assault and battery convictions and the granting of a protective order against her husband, Jamie. The issues in the case before the court, besides the grounds for divorce, were equitable distribution issues, which consisted primarily of two items.
Counsel, let me interrupt you if I can. This case was bifurcated pursuant to 20-103A, right?
That's correct.
And the bifurcation is not an issue before us at all.
It is not.
About that. I gather she was ill at the time, and she died shortly after the order of bifurcation was entered. Is that correct?
Yeah. Actually, Your Honor, at the hearing on the issues, the evidentiary hearing on the issues for the grounds for divorce and the equitable distribution, actually, Miss Warmington wasn't present. She had suffered a stroke. She was so ill that she couldn't attend. So her daughter, who was also her power of attorney, testified along with another witness. That was in August of last year. August 16th is when the court entered the divorce decree, and that was at the request of Miss Warmington to bifurcate it because of the fact that the main assets of the estate were two parcels of real estate that were held by tenants by the entirety.
Well,
so
when the order, but the circuit court here determined, I guess ultimately it didn't have jurisdiction because she was deceased. Is that correct?
It didn't have jurisdiction over the remaining equitable distribution or property issues that arose out of the marriage because she died. Literally, she died a week before the court issued its opinion on the equitable distribution.
Are you familiar with our? It's a very recent case, Freeman versus Smith.
Yes, and I actually cited that in my brief, Your Honor. There is a footnote in that case that I draw the court's attention to that alludes to the fact that there are really the possibility that if the parties are divorced, their remaining property issues could be potentially carried on by the executor or representatives of that deceased spouse's estate.
So I noticed you didn't take this position on brief, and I suspect that was largely because Friedman was either not out at the time of your original brief and maybe maybe it hadn't been fully digested yet, but it seems to me that as a general proposition, the circuit court loses jurisdiction. Over a divorce case upon the death of the parties because the death dissolves the marriage. You know, in other words, the court doesn't need to dissolve the marriage because the death of one of the parties will do that. But where a divorce occurs prior to the death of one of the parties, would it be your position the court still retains jurisdiction? And you asked for a non-pro-tunk order in this case, and I'm just wondering why that's necessary if the court retained jurisdiction.
Well, I think the non-pro-tunk is maybe an alternative argument. I think my primary argument would be exactly what you alluded to, which is if the court has granted the divorce and then one of the spouses dies, but there are remaining property or marital property rights to be adjudicated, the court certainly would retain jurisdiction to decide those issues because I think there is a difference between the courts. Certainly, the case law is held that when parties are married, their death abates the divorce action, but that's the action to end the marriage because obviously the death ends the marriage. But then once the divorce is granted, that doesn't necessarily mean that if one of the spouses pass away and there's remaining property issues to adjudicate that the court loses jurisdiction of those issues. And that's what the trial court did in this case. It basically said, even though we've divorced the Warmingtons and there was equitable distribution and property rights to decide, once Miss Warmington died, the trial court says we lose jurisdiction to decide those issues. And that's, I think, contrary to what was alluded to in the Friedman case, certainly in the footnote one, where it talked about the personal representatives of the husband's estate are the successors in interest to husband with respect to any equitable distribution of marital property and support issues. Those matters have been bifurcated and are not part of this case, and the estate has no proper role and interest in the divorce litigation itself. Again, in Friedman, it was a little different because the divorce litigation, the issue on appeal was the court had granted a bifurcated divorce, and the wife, I believe, in that case, appealed the actual entry of the divorce decree, and there hadn't been the hearing or resolution of the equitable distribution or equitable property issues.
I have some familiarity with Friedman.
So, yeah, and you're right. It was a recent case. I did cite it in my brief. I think it came out literally as I was writing the final drafts of it. So that's I did reference it in my brief and did reference that footnote number one.
But, counsel, you don't have any authority that allows, that certainly supports your position aside from the what you allude to in Friedman, which would be the next step. Isn't that correct? In other words, this would be, this is a case of first impression. Is that not correct?
It is somewhat a case of first impression. Yes, clearly there hasn't been a case that has clearly determined that if there's a bifurcated divorce and the divorce, the marriage is ended by a divorce decree, but there are equitable distribution issues remaining. There is no case from Virginia that has adjudicated that, saying that the right of the trial court continues on. There's certainly support from some other states. I recited a case, the Risk case from Minnesota. It's really the same fact pattern as this case, which was the parties were divorced by a bifurcated divorce. In the interim, one of the spouses died. In that particular case, the Court of Appeals in Minnesota held that the general continuation of or survival of the action statute carried on, and therefore the executors had the right to continue to pursue the equitable distribution.
Okay. Counsel, how basically what you're asking us to do is to take that next step without the benefit of the General Assembly giving us guidance or handing down a law, to take that next step and have you thought about, or did you consider when you came forward in this case, how that might affect ultimately property rights in reference to any of the death statutes when you're looking at wills, estates, intestacy, all those issues? That's going to impact it. If we step forward and we grant what you're asking, then we're going to be changing not just the divorce proceedings, but also, because by operation of law, some of that property would have passed immediately upon death.
Well, and again, I think the facts of this case make it somewhat unique because of the fact that it was a bifurcated divorce and the divorce action ended the marriage, which, of course, that terminates the surviving spouse rights under the various sections of the code involving augmented estate, elective rights, all the rights that a surviving spouse would have in a state because the divorce ended those rights. So this is really kind of a narrow issue in the unique situation that you have in this case, which is a divorce has been granted, but the property rights have not been adjudicated. And I would just go back to the kind of a bigger issue on this case is, of course, the equitable distribution statute. It is the purpose behind it is allocation of marital wealth, marital property, and just it has a different mechanism or different potential outcomes applying that statute and the factors that are considered in it versus just if it's a co-tenancy survivorship. And really, Ms. Warmington is deprived of that allocation of marital wealth in this case.
Well, how does she move forward on an equitable distribution now that she's deceased? And if you look through, of course, then we're all familiar with the code section and all of the subsections of the issues that are required to be addressed and presented, evidence received by the court in order to make an equitable distribution award. How do you go forward with that in the absence of your client?
Well, and again, in this particular case, it's unique because the day that the divorce was granted, we presented all the evidence to the court, and the court actually, in the letter opinion October 10th, made a decision on equitable distribution, but then essentially took it back because she died prior to the issuance of that opinion. So, again, it is somewhat of a unique fact pattern. I would agree that if we had not had any evidence or presented any of the factors the court would have to consider, it would be difficult in this case because she passed away. But, again, that's not what happened in this case. The issue or the evidence had been presented and the court had made a decision on equitable distribution in its October 10th letter opinion.
But as Judge Chafin was alluding to earlier, if property by spouses is owned as tenants by the entirety, and the divorce is granted, it doesn't change that deed title, correct?
No, that's incorrect. If it's tensed by the entirety and the divorce is granted, then it changes the classification of that property to a co-tenant.
The classification, but not the title.
The title is actually co-tenant, but it doesn't change the potential classification of whether it's marital or separate. There's kind of two different...
But if one spouse dies at that point, doesn't the surviving spouse own the property by title?
If it's tenants by the entirety,
yes,
and they are still married, and that's the only way you can have tenants by the entirety,
yes,
is through a marriage, yes, you're right. If one spouse dies, the surviving spouse becomes the 100% owner of that, and that was one of the considerations the trial court made in this case as to why to bifurcate it, because Ms. Warmington had essentially brought, or it was her efforts that brought all the real estate into the marriage and retitled it in the husband's name, tenants by the entirety. So the trial court was aware of the fundamental unfairness that would result if the divorce wasn't granted and she died in the interim. Mr. Warmington would be the 100% owner of all the real estate.
Well, let me follow up on that, Justice Clement's question then. If do I understand correctly that it's basically your position that in terms of statutory construction, you're harmonizing all these various statutes, it would go something like this: because the bifurcation took place and is uncontested, the divorce was granted prior to death, therefore the court has to follow through with its obligation to divide marital property, but the death may have an effect on how that division occurs because of other statutes that change the nature of marital property upon the death of one of the former spouses, I guess. And here the court, you know, wrote a letter opinion, but of course it doesn't really have any legal effect because it never embodied it in an order. But I mean, assuming the court still retains jurisdiction to do something with this case, is this as simple as just remanding it to the court to say, you know, essentially cite Freedman and say, you still have jurisdiction, proceed, and then if the court makes further errors along the way in dividing up the property in consideration of the wife's death, deal with that if it ever comes up on appeal again?
Right, yes. What I would ask the court to do is remand it to say, A, first of all, the trial court already made an adjudication of the property issues based on the evidence that it heard at the evidentiary hearing, embodied it in its letter opinion, and what really needs to happen now is make that letter opinion the kind of final order in the case.
I don't know that we can do that.
Right.
Because there is no order, you know, to be appealed from there. The only order that's appealable is the order saying I don't have jurisdiction,
right,
to do anything.
I understand that, but if it's remanded, at least then I guess the trial court would have the full realm of deciding, well, am I going to implement the decision that I that the
but,
court
but we don't do advisory opinions, so I don't think it's appropriate for us to say, now on remand, here's what you need to do. I mean,
right,
it seems to me the court needs to, you know, we're not there, we haven't heard the evidence with respect to the division of the property and that sort of thing. That's really not, strictly speaking, before us, it seems to me. So, I mean, the court needs to, you know, it seems to me your best situation is we agree with you that the court retained jurisdiction, send it back and say, finish doing what you're supposed to do, and then if that becomes a further issue on appeal, deal with it at the appropriate time.
Yeah, and I would agree. I think that would be the appropriate remedy, is just to remand it, say the court continues to have jurisdiction, which is essentially what the issue is in this case, and then the trial court can decide what to do with the evidence that was presented to it and how to allocate the property at that point.
I assume you're abandoning your request for net protect order. You understand that cannot be granted.
I understand that. That was my alternative argument. It was an alternative argument, but I think my stronger points are the assignments of error regarding the court's jurisdiction and the use of the general survival of cause of action right. The Freedman, citing the Freedman case and the footnote that this court provided in that case, those are what I'm relying upon for the court to make a decision in the case. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Dwyer. We'll come down, as is our custom, and greet counsel.